Today, one of the most dangerous forces threatening the church and free, just societies is the environmental movement, no longer recognizable as the common sense, people-friendly, even God-honoring conservationist movement from which it derived. It has become an alternative worldview and even a substitute religion, with its own false doctrines of God, creation, humanity, sin, and salvation. Sadly, this radically anti-Christian worldview, theology, and ethic has successfully infiltrated many churches, beguiling many Christians into unwittingly trading the heritage of biblical faith for a new false green religion. Many Christians have uncritically embraced the implications, and sometimes even the premises, of the environmentalists' atheism or pantheism, the topsy-turvy value system that protects eagles' eggs, but approves of aborting babies or euthanizing the elderly in the name of population control, and the exaggerated and often downright fraudulent claims of eco-disaster by leading environmentalists and their allies in the media and government. Stay tuned for my interview with scholar and climate change expert Cal Beisner next, here on the Soaring Eagle Radio Show.
Remember that your failure to be informed does not make me a wacko.
The time has come, the walrus said. You talk of other things, of shoes and ships and sealing wax and cabbages and kings.
My mind doesn't work that way. I got this real moron thing I do. It's called thinking. And I'm not a very good American because I like to form my own opinions. I have certain rules I live by. My first rule, I don't believe anything the government tells me. And I don't take very seriously the media or the press in this country.
Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
Nine most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
This is your last chance. After this, there is no turning back. You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
It's called the American Dream because you have to be asleep to believe it.
Hello, and welcome to Soaring Eagle Radio. Your host is Mike Spaulding. Get ready to be challenged and encouraged as you consider today's news and Mike's commentary from a biblical perspective. Now, let's join Mike.
Welcome to the Soaring Eagle Radio Show, friends. Remember, you can subscribe to the show on iTunes, follow us on Twitter at Soaring Eagle Rad, and Facebook, as well as download or listen to episodes of the show on our website, www.soaringeagleradio.com. My guest today is Dr. E. Calvin Beisner, National Spokesman for the Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation. Dr. Beisner is a former Associate Professor of Historical Theology and Social Ethics at Knox Theological Seminary in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Welcome to the Soaring Eagle Radio Show, Cal.
Thank you very much, Mike. Good to be with you.
Well, thank you. Cal, I've appreciated you and the work of Cornwall Alliance since I became aware of you and it many years ago. I want to briefly quote from the Cornwall Alliance Stewardship Introduction document because I think it succinctly captures the foundational philosophy and motivating principles for the what and the why of the Cornwall Alliance. So for our listeners, This is what that says, just a few paragraphs. This is a quote. Secularist thought provides no rational basis for a stewardship ethic. For according to it, humans are simply a product of random causes in a random universe. Some modern environmentalists take an even more extreme view of humans, seeing such a limitless obligation to nature as to make the existence and prosperity of humanity a curse on the world. In this view, untouched nature is the ideal, and virtually all human activity results in degradation. Thus, the ethical ideal is not to tend nature wisely, but to restrict most human activity. The Bible, in contrast, places humanity both within and above nature. We are created out of the dust of the earth and are commanded to be fruitful, yet we have stewardship over the earth and all its creatures. Thus, humans are not merely a part of nature, We have obligations towards nature. As biblical Christians, we reject the secular extremes in favor of the balanced biblical picture. God has made humans for his eternal purpose and has given us an earthly home to tend and care for and to be sustained by for a time. As a consequence, biblical revelation provides a sound basis for humane creation stewardship, particularly as it relates to energy supply and climate change. Consistent with these observations, the Cornwall Declaration proclaims that human beings are created in the image of God, given a privileged place among the creatures, and commanded to exercise stewardship over the earth. God's law, outlined in the Decalogue given to Moses and summarized by Jesus as loving God and loving our neighbors as ourselves, provides the framework for the proper exercise of the stewardship with which humans have been charged. A fundamental principle of the Cornwall Declaration is this: human persons are moral agents for whom freedom is an essential condition of responsible action. The Declaration also states sound environmental stewardship must attend both to the demands of human well-being and to a divine call for human beings to exercise care and dominion over the earth, end quote. And that is a mouthful, but it is very well-rounded. Cal, based on what I just shared about the Cornwall Alliance, would you fill in the gaps as you see the need and tell us about Cornwall Alliance and its mission?
Well, yeah, the Cornwall Alliance, Mike, is a network of about 60 different scholars spread around North America, all of them evangelical Christians committed to the authority of Scripture and to the gospel of Jesus Christ. And we have as our mission really a threefold task. We want to promote three things through educational efforts. The first is what we call biblical earth stewardship, or godly dominion. We're capitalizing there on the language of Genesis 1:28, where having created Adam and Eve in his own image, God blessed them and said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea, the birds of the air, and everything that moves on the face of the earth." This dominion is supposed to be a godly dominion. That is, it's not abusive, it's not reckless or careless, but rather it reflects the way God himself rules his creation, and it reflects God's own creative activity reported in the first 26 verses of Genesis, where God brings, where God makes everything out of nothing, and then he brings light out of darkness and order out of chaos. He brings greater order out of lesser order and life out of non-living things, and he brings tremendous variety of life, and he wants each of the different kinds of life to multiply and fill its own niche in the earth. And then he creates mankind in his own image, that is unique among all the creatures, and he tells mankind to fill not a particular niche in the earth, but the whole earth, and to have dominion over all of it. And so this dominion that we have should reflect God's dominion in that, the way we put it, it would be men and women created in God's image, working together to enhance the fruitfulness, the beauty, and the safety of the earth to the glory of God and to the benefit of our neighbors. So that's the first of the three things that we want to promote through our educational activities. The second is economic development for the very poor around the world. Think in terms of places like sub-Saharan Africa or Haiti, parts of Latin America and Asia, where many people live on less than the equivalent of about $1.25 a day. In U.S. dollars. They're really living in abject poverty and consequently suffering very, very high rates of disease and premature death. They lack just basic kinds of measures of human well-being that you and I are very accustomed to. And we recognize, both because of biblical revelation and because of what we learn from history, that in order for whole societies to rise out of poverty, you really need two things. One is a set of moral and legal and cultural institutions characterized by the rights of private property and respect for private property, free trade, limited government, the rule of law, that is, the equal application of all laws to all people without any favoritism, without any special privileges for anyone, and so on. And the other is access to abundant, affordable, reliable energy. It takes energy to do any kind of work.
Right.
And, of course, the more energy that we can harness in addition to our own muscles, the more work can be done. And the more work can be done, the more food, clothing, shelter, and all the other things that that benefit human life can be made. And then the third thing that we promote is the proclamation and defense of the gospel of Jesus Christ, that Christ died for our sins according to the scriptures, he was buried, he rose again from the dead according to the scriptures. This is the gospel that Paul says is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes. And it is by believing that Christ has died for me and that he rose again from the dead in victory over sin for me, that I'm justified, I'm forgiven of my sin, and I'm reconciled to a holy God, so that then, instead of being under the wrath of God as a sinner, I am under the care and the blessing of God. And we do all of this, Mike, in a world that's permeated by an environmental movement that, as you described a minute ago in quoting from the Cornwall Declaration, has its own doctrines of God, creation, humanity, sin, and salvation, and really is a total alternative to Christianity. And so we want to present the true Christian faith in distinction from that, because it's as people are reconciled to God that they begin moving to his word, going to the scriptures to learn about the disciplines of a godly life, and that's what brings the blessing of God in our lives and is necessary for people to rise out of poverty and to enjoy a fruitful and healthful life here on the earth.
Yes. Climate change, information, debate, however you want to define it, it is rarely out of the news these days. Recently, Pope Francis issued an encyclical, which many in the media are referring to as the climate encyclical, where he said, among other things, that improving the circumstances of the world's poor must be a priority. And well, there's no question that today we have the ability to do many things to improve the lives of the world's poor. However, Pope Francis made a serious error in attempting to make his case for climate change without fully understanding the current scientific evidence, and that suggests something far different from what climate change advocates claim. Would you share your thoughts on Pope Francis's encyclical and perhaps even point out what you perceive to be some of the weaknesses in his argument, Cal?
Sure. And your listeners, by the way, Mike, can read an open letter to Pope Francis that we put together and was signed by hundreds of very fine scientists as well as theologians and economists and ethicists and so on,
yes,
by going to climateletter2popefrancis.org. That's climateletter2popefrancis.org.
Yes.
They can get a lot more details from that than they can from what I can say here just over the air.
Sure.
But you know, the first thing to point out, by the way, is that the encyclical is not only about climate change. In fact, I think it's about 220 different sections in the encyclical, only four focus on climate change. Subject occurs again and again through the encyclical, but only four focus on that. And frankly, they're probably the four weakest sections in the entire encyclical.
Yeah.
Other parts draw a whole lot on a variety of different sources. They're well supported by citations. These four sections, surprisingly enough, have no citations at all.
Mm.
And so it's apparent that when he got to that topic, the Pope was and his advisors were outside the realm of their own serious study.
Mm-hmm.
As a result, what they did was they took for granted the very widespread claims of the climate alarmists, who have basically the favor of the media and of a lot of politicians, that there's this overwhelming scientific consensus that human activity, particularly the burning of fossil fuels, resulting in the emission of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, is driving dangerous climate change, and that it is going to be worthwhile to spend trillions of dollars trying to prevent that. Unfortunately for, I think, the reputation of Pope Francis and his advisors, the actual evidence is quite contrary to that, and we summarize that in the open letter essentially this way, by pointing out that all of the fears of dangerous man-made climate change or global warming rest on the simulations of climate by computerized models of the global climate.
Yes.
The problem is models are useful only insofar as they're validated. Mm-hmm. And they're validated when they make predictions that correlate well with, that agree well with, actual observations in the real world.
Yes.
The problem here is that, on average, the climate models simulate twice as much warming as actually observed over the relevant period. Over 95% of the models simulate more warming than has actually occurred, and what that entails is that the errors are not random. If they were random, they'd be often, as often below as above the observations. But instead, the errors must be driven by some sort of bias that's written into the models themselves.
Yes, right.
And then finally, none of the models simulated the complete absence of statistically significant global warming for anywhere from the last 18 to 27 years, depending on which data set you look at. 18 and a half years, according to the satellite data, which are the most reliable that we have. So, frankly, the models are wrong. They are invalidated rather than validated by real-world observation. And since they're wrong, they provide no rational basis for any fears about future climate, and therefore no rational basis for any policies at all.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, Pope Francis and his advisors have endorsed the idea that we need to make drastic reductions in CO2 emissions. And the only way to do that is to make drastic reductions in the use of fossil fuels for energy.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with that is that those are the most abundant, affordable, reliable sources for energy for the vast majority of the world. And without them, you are going to essentially condemn large parts of the world, those parts that are still in poverty, to continuing in poverty for generations to come. And frankly, their poverty is a far greater risk for them than any kind of climate change that has been predicted, even by the most alarmist people in the movement.
Yeah. Now, the Roman Catholic Church is not the only religious organization that accepts and promotes the global warming climate change position. There are many evangelicals that have, in my opinion, inexplicably thrown their lot in with the climate change advocates. The Cornwall Alliance addressed that in a document called An Open Letter to the Signers of Climate Change, an Evangelical Call to Action. And as I was reading that, Cal, it looks to me that you are attempting to assist evangelicals in a greater understanding of the issues surrounding climate change. And so the first order of business in this attempt is to address the so-called scientific consensus on catastrophic human-induced global warming. Would you take us through the scientific evidence against this belief that there is a scientific consensus?
Well, the very first thing to point out, by the way, is that consensus is not even a scientific value.
That's a good point.
Consensus counts in politics. Whoever gets the most votes, well, he's the guy who gets elected to office. But it doesn't matter how many people agree with you. If the evidence is contrary, then according to science, you're wrong. In fact, one of the greatest scientists of the 20th century, the Nobel Prize-winning physicist Richard Feynman, said that the key to science is this: that we try to discover a law of nature, a law of physics, for instance, by first guessing at it, and then we make predictions based on that guess, and then we compare the predictions with observations in the laboratory, in experiments, or out in the outside world. And he said, if the observations disagree with the predictions, then the guess is wrong, period. It doesn't matter how smart you are, mm-hmm. or how beautiful your guess is, or how many people agree with you, it's wrong. So consensus isn't even a scientific value in the first place. Mm. Secondly, every attempt that's been made to prove that there is this consensus behind dangerous man-made global warming has turned out to have been fallacious. They've been based on literary surveys where people badly misunderstood the abstracts of technical articles, where they misinterpreted the articles themselves. In many instances, the authors of the articles wound up saying, oh, well, this was counted as an article in favor of the so-called consensus, but actually it isn't. I disagree with the consensus. Mm-hmm. That's happened again and again. The closest we've come to any good evidence about consensus would be two different things. One, a poll of the American Meteorological Society about 2 years ago that found that about 53% of the members of the AMS agreed that recent global warming had been primarily driven by human activities. But that's just 53%. That's not strong at all. And besides that, that doesn't go to the question whether it's dangerous and to the question whether it's, you know, whether it would be worthwhile to spend trillions of dollars trying to prevent it.
Right.
The second is an article just published this past month in July, and at the moment I can't remember where it was published, but it was by a group of Dutch researchers who surveyed thousands and thousands of climate scientists, and they concluded that only about 43% of them agree with the claim in the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's most recent major assessment report of 95% confidence that human activity has been the primary driver of most of the climate change over the last roughly 50 years. Only about 43% of climate scientists agree with that. So the notion of consensus is not well supported by the actual evidence. And even if it were, that's not a scientific value at all. As a matter of fact, consensus has been overturned many times in the history of science. It used to be consensus that continents don't move. Well, now we have the theory of continental drift, and that is the new consensus. It used to be the consensus that ulcers are caused by stress. Now we know that ulcers are caused primarily by bacterial infections. So consensus in science disappears over and over again. It's not a good way to figure out what's true.
Yeah. One of the charges that I've read over the years, heard from supporters, advocates of global warming, climate change, is this charge that, well, you folks that deny it, you really just don't care about the poor. That's really what the issue is here. And yet, the Cornwall Alliance has addressed that almost every time that they've put out a paper. One that comes to mind, Cal, is the document, A Call to Truth, Prudence and Protection of the Poor, an Evangelical Response to Global Warming. In that paper, for our listeners who will go find that, and that's on your website, I believe. I think that's where I found
it. Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Best way to find that and all of our major papers like that is to go to cornwallalliance.org and then just click on the tab called Landmark Documents.
Yes.
And you'll get a list of those most important documents that we've put out.
Yeah. And so for our listeners, you'll find this one there as well. Download, read, make copies, distribute. But A Call to Truth, Prudence and Protection of the Poor, an Evangelical Response to Global Warming. It really contains very sound biblical principles for approaching climate change proposals with the world's poor in mind as a primary subject. Could you share with us some of those principles from that document, Cal?
Oh, yeah. As I said at the very beginning, economic development for the very poor around the world is one of the three major emphases we have. in addition to biblical earth stewardship and the gospel of Christ. And what we point out, among other things, is that abundant, affordable, reliable energy is absolutely crucial to lifting and keeping any society out of abject poverty. No society has ever overcome poverty without that, and in fact, no society has ever overcome poverty without getting that abundant, affordable, reliable energy primarily from fossil fuels. And the reason for this is fairly straightforward. People who are not familiar with the physics and energy, the physics and engineering of how we get energy wouldn't necessarily recognize this right off the bat. But energy can be derived from a variety of different sources. But there's a concept in physics and engineering called energy density. That's how much energy is stored within a particular volume of a substance. The energy density of wind and solar is very, very low. The energy density of coal and natural gas and oil is very, very high. Well, in order to have energy really serve us, we have to concentrate that energy a great deal, and it has to be very, very pure. There has to be little fluctuation in it. So it has to be abundant, it has to be concentrated, it has to be reliable, it has to be non-intermittent, it has to be very, very steady. Well, wind and solar are, by their very nature, low density and very, very unstable. They fluctuate a great deal. Yes. So it's much more expensive to concentrate and purify and make steady and perfectly sound the energy from wind and solar than it is to concentrate and purify and make steady the energy from coal, oil, and natural gas. Mm-hmm. Consequently, the cost of producing electricity from wind and solar or biofuels, for instance, is much, much higher than the cost of producing it from fossil fuels. Mm. And as a result, since energy is a part of the cost of everything else that we do, whether it's making food, clothing, shelter, buildings, anything else, right, or providing services or transporting people, whatever, energy is a part of the cost of everything that we do. If you raise the cost of energy, you raise the cost of everything else. Mm-hmm. And so since the poor are the ones who are the hardest hit by increases in prices, when we're asked to fight global warming by switching from fossil fuels to wind and solar as primary energy sources, we're really being asked to harm the poor by raising prices across the board, but particularly prices for energy. And as it turns out, the poor, on average, spend about twice as much of their income on energy as do the non-poor in the United States. Yeah. And so if you increase the price of energy, it actually acts like a regressive tax. You're taxing the poor at a higher rate than you're taxing the rich. So we just recognize that doing this harms the poor, and that's been our primary motivation in all of this right from the start. You know, motivation and justification are different things. Motivation is, you know, why do we care about this?
Yes.
And I care about this because I care about the poor. Mm-hmm. Justification is, you know, what's the evidence? And the evidence is that human emission of CO2 has not had a significant effect on global average temperature, mm-hmm. and it certainly is not going to have a dangerous effect on it. And then the evidence is that trying to reduce our emissions is going to cause huge harm to the poor.
Yes. Economist Walter Williams addressed that issue, and he always speaks with precise clarity. And he said this about climate change. He said, and this is a quote, "Truly compassionate policy requires dispassionate analysis." What I take from that, at least one thing that I take from that quote, is that good intentions do not necessarily make good policy. And I think that's
absolutely
that's the point you've been trying to make. So one derivative of objective analysis of the issue of global warming and climate change, Cal, and this is going to appear counterintuitive to some of our listeners, but promoting economic growth to address climate change makes perfect sense. But why is that?
Well, economic growth is what enables people to afford environmental stewardship.
Yes.
If you're worried about putting food on the table, clothes on the back, and a roof over the head, you frankly don't care much about smog, chemical runoff into streams, or anything else of that sort. And frankly, also, if you're worried about putting food on the table, clothes on the back, and a roof over the head, you also don't care much about what the weather's going to be tomorrow. Because you just have far more urgent issues in mind. So even if you were to assume that the fears of dangerous man-made warming driven by the use of fossil fuels are well justified, the notion that we would be wise to try to prevent that by reducing the fossil fuels, the use of fossil fuels for energy, is quite mistaken, because what's going to be needed in order simultaneously to lift people out of poverty and keep them out of poverty, on the one hand, and to reduce our dependence on fossil fuels, is wealth.
Yes.
Wealthy people are the ones who can afford to use wind and solar.
Right.
Well, that means that unless you are ready to say, okay, we're going to leave the roughly 2 billion people in the world right now who are so poor that they don't have electricity, we're willing to leave them in poverty permanently, forever, okay?
Yeah.
Unless you are willing to say that, then you have to be willing instead to say, we're willing to watch them get wealthy the same way we did, namely by using fossil fuels, and once they are wealthy, then they can switch from fossil fuels to fuels that don't result in high emissions of carbon dioxide.
Yes. Yeah. That's a great response, Cal. God gave to human beings a mandate to cultivate and guard the garden, to fill, subdue, and rule the whole earth. That's Genesis chapter 1. And that suggests, in the least, that caring for human needs goes hand in hand with caring for the earth. Author and theologian Wayne Grudem, whom I know you're very familiar with, Cal, says that it doesn't seem likely to me that God would set up the world to work in such a way that human beings would eventually destroy the earth by doing such ordinary and morally good and necessary things as breathing, building a fire to cook and keep warm, burning fuel to travel, or using energy for a refrigerator to preserve food. One of the things that I appreciate so much about the Cornwall Alliance is that you seek to bring a theological perspective to the discussion of global warming, climate change, and really this perspective sees man as God's crowning achievement and the earth as man's specially designed home. You've brought together a very impressive group of pastors, theologians, scholars, and ministry leaders. Would you care to mention some of those people, Cal, that have joined you in advocating for a more godly perspective on climate change?
Oh, sure. You just mentioned one of them. That's Wayne Grudem, a very, very fine systematic theologian. Wayne has been on our advisory board right from the time we started, and he's also a senior fellow for the Cornwall Alliance. He's done some lecturing for us and so on. Some others that I might mention, let's start with some climatologists, since that's a significant part of our discussion here. Dr. Roy Spencer, who is principal research scientist at the University of Alabama in Huntsville, he is also the U.S. science team leader on NASA's satellite program that gives us worldwide, all latitudes, all longitudes, all altitudes, temperature measurements for the entire atmosphere from satellites. He is the primary scientist in control of that experiment. And He's one of our senior fellows. He's been the lead author of the science sections of several of our papers. Mm. Another climatologist who works with us is Dr. David LeGates, who's a professor of climatology at the University of Delaware. And then to move to another field of scholarship, economists are very important in this, and a leading economist in this field is Dr. G. Cornelis Van Kooten, or Case Van Kooten, as he's called. He is a professor of environmental economics and the Canada chair in climate and economics at the University of Victoria in British Columbia. He's written several books in the field and is one of the world's just absolutely outstanding scholars in that field. Another is a Dr. Timothy Terrell of Wofford College in South Carolina. Dr. Terrell is a specialist on environmental regulation economics. So there are a couple of examples. There are a number of other people. One great example would be Dr. Craig Mitchell. He is a professor at Criswell College in Dallas, Texas. Yes. Craig is an interesting fellow in that he's multi-degreed in different fields. He's got a Ph.D. in theology, a Ph.D. in philosophy. He's finishing his Ph.D. in economics.
Oh,
he also has a Ph.D. in engineering, and has done the kind of engineering modeling that that the climate modelers try to do. So, Craig is able to bring theology and ethics and engineering and economics, all of these things together into this. So these are the sorts of people that we work with.
Yeah.
And I think that's why we're able to bring that dispassionate analysis that Walter Williams refers to into our approach to every one of these issues.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned Dr. Terrell. He serves as a senior fellow there at the Cornwall Alliance. He wrote a brilliant treatise that I was reading the other day, and this is available on the Cornwall Alliance website as well for our listeners.
Yes.
It's entitled "The Cost of Good Intentions, The Ethics and Economics of the War on Conventional Energy." I'll read that again. "The Cost of Good Intentions, The Ethics and Economics of the War on Conventional Energy." And I would just tell our listeners, if you're going to go download this and want to read it, you might want to set aside some time. It's a 39-page document, and it's an excellent read. But I want to share just one paragraph, Cal, and then let you respond. But Dr. Terrell wrote, he said, "The pastoral call requires shepherding a congregation through difficult circumstances, including challenges from the spiritual message and economic consequences of environmentalism. It's difficult to develop the knowledge and wisdom necessary to give biblical counsel on such issues, especially in light of complex scientific problems and intense policy debates. Yet, the church must evaluate alarms raised about the environment and policies to address them. This paper, The Cost of Good Intentions, is intended to assist ministry leaders, policymakers, regulators, and the public in understanding and applying biblical worldview, theology, and ethics, coupled with excellent science and economics, to promote a free, prosperous, and just society in a fruitful, beautiful, and safe environment," end quote. Dr. Terrell then goes on to expand in the introduction in three-part work, "The Theological Foundation for Speaking Biblically About Climate Change Alarmism and the Need to Address These Issues in the Church." I was wondering, Cal, as you're familiar with this document, if you would expand upon that brief introduction, thinking biblically about the environment, where does stewardship come in, markets and prosperity, regulation. And I know that's a mouthful, but I'll just let you go and address that.
Yeah, well, as you said, it is quite an extensive paper,
and I
really do think it's just an extraordinary job that
yes.
Dr. Terrell did for us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is one of the things that I appreciate so much about him and all the other people who work with us, is that they all of them integrate a biblical worldview and theological and ethical approach with their particular academic expertise, whether it might be climate science, it might be geology, it might be physics. In Timothy's case, it's economics, in particular the economics of regulation, of environmental regulation. And what Dr. Terrell does is he first discusses the nature of mankind and what it really means to be human, to be made in the image of God, to have this responsibility of freedom that we use not for the sake of selfishness, but rather for the sake of being able to serve other people. This is something that really flourishes only in a social context where that freedom is as unrestricted as possible,
yes,
without just turning into license, without turning into chaos.
Yeah.
And so Dr. Terrell actually discusses how the regulatory state undermines the very social structure necessary for the responsible expression of human freedom. He also then discusses the responsibilities that we have as image bearers of God to look after the well-being of our neighbors. Of course, the two great commandments are to love God and to love our neighbor.
Yes.
And he made reference in there to how what we want to bring about is an environment that is where we have enhanced the fruitfulness, the beauty, and the safety of the earth to the glory of God and the benefit of our neighbors. That really addresses those two great commandments.
Yes.
So those are some of the ways that he integrates this. He also points out in some of his discussion how, as we understand that God designed the earth, we would expect that he'd have designed it to be robust, resilient, and sort of self-correcting, not to be extremely fragile and prone to complete catastrophe in response to comparatively minor causes. We've discussed that in several of our other documents as well, such as the Call to Truth that you referred to earlier. The notion, for instance, that we're going to get dangerous or even catastrophic climate change because we add carbon dioxide to the atmosphere, it, at first blush, it can sound plausible. People will say, hey, we've gone from 280 parts per million CO2 in the atmosphere to now 400 parts per million. That's a 40% increase. That's big. Well, but wait a minute. It's a 40% increase on 0.028%. That means we're now at 0.004%. That's kind of like saying, that if a fly lands on my nose, it's going to cause my whole body to collapse. Well, no, not likely.
That's right.
In fact, a fly would be a whole lot bigger percentage of my weight than 0.004%.
That's right.
So that really treats the climate system as if it's extremely fragile.
Yes.
That's not consistent with our understanding that the climate system and everything else on Earth was designed by a God who is infinitely wise. It was created by a God who is infinitely powerful, and it is being sustained by a God who is infinitely faithful and who promised himself in Genesis 8:21 that as long as earth endures, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, night and day will not cease. These are the cycles on which life depends. And essentially he's saying, I am pledged to sustain those cycles as long as I sustain the earth itself.
Yes. Yeah. We've mentioned several resources in our conversation, and again, I encourage our listeners to go to the Cornwall Alliance website and search for the various resources that are there to help equip and educate them on this topic. I'd like to zero in, though, Cal. What resources are available specifically, or perhaps were designed with pastors in mind who are interested in teaching their fellowships the principles of sound biblical stewardship of the earth?
Yeah. Well, certainly they could start off for some very short things with the Cornwall Declaration on Environmental Stewardship. That's just 2 pages, and it's quite clear and simple. You quoted from it at the outset of this interview. Mm-hmm. A second major one of that sort would be, the Biblical Perspective on Environmental Stewardship. And that's 30 principles drawn from Scripture, put together in the form of affirmations and denials. We affirm this, we deny that, put the opposite of it, on this issue. That's a great way to get, to get a grasp on basic principles of these things.
Yes.
Then we have some, a number of major papers. We've talked about a few. For instance, our open letter to Pope Francis at climatelettertopopefrancis.org, and several different editions that we've done of A Call to Truth, Prudence, and Protection of the Poor that we put out in 2006, 2009, and then 2014. These are all available under landmark documents at our homepage, cornwallalliance.org. Okay. Then we also have a number of different audio-visual resources. One is a set of 12 lectures plus a half-hour documentary on DVDs, 4 DVDs, called Resisting the Green Dragon. Mm. And really, this is a full curriculum in a box for a Sunday school series, 13-week series, small group, private Christian school, homeschooling, and so on. And these 12 lectures really expose the anti-Christian worldview, theology, and ethics, and the poor science and economics of the environmental movement, and therefore how it endangers the sanctity of human life, it endangers human welfare, and of course it threatens the very gospel itself. So those are available all as that one set, Resisting the Green Dragon. We have a number of other DVDs available. One of them is called Godly Dominion versus Environmentalism, a lecture that I've done at a number of different places that really sort of gives the whole history and whole case in theory and in practice of environmentalism versus a biblical understanding of what earth stewardship should be.
Yes.
So that's available. We have one called Science Standards, Political or Pure, that is a critique of the next generation science standards being imposed on many of our public schools now alongside the Common Core that turns science education really into propaganda for atheism and for environmentalism, and particularly for global warming alarmism.
Mm-hmm.
All of those are available, and quite a few other things. And one of the simplest things that pastors can do, or others as well, is simply to subscribe to our free email newsletter that comes out once or twice a week, and it's always educational.
Yes.
And they can also follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/Cornwall Alliance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I want to encourage our listeners, you don't need to be a pastor. If you're a believer in the Lord Jesus Christ, I want to highly encourage you to check out the DVD curriculum series, Resisting the Green Dragon. I actually taught that series at my fellowship, even though it says it's 12, I think it's 12 lectures, Cal.
Yes, 12 lectures and a half-hour documentary.
Yeah, I think we probably took about 24 weeks to go through it because it was so good that we ended up stopping for discussion on many of the principles and truths that were being presented, just to make sure that folks are grasping it. So go out and check that out, Resisting the Green Dragon DVD curriculum. It's very good, and I highly recommend it. So any new initiatives that Cornwall Alliance is engaged in right now, Cal, that you want to share with our listeners?
Well, we are just about to go public with a new open letter to the American people and to their political representatives at all levels, giving the basic scientific evidence against climate alarmism and the basic economic case that trying to fight climate change by switching away from fossil fuels is really to condemn the poor to more generations of poverty. That we're just about ready to go public on it. We've got nearly 300 signers now of major scholars of all sorts, and then we'll take it to the regular public. We also are preparing to release videos of about an eight-hour informal debate situation where Dr. John Christie, who is a climatologist at the University of Alabama, partnered with Roy Spencer, who I mentioned earlier, and Dr. Ross McKittrick, who's an environmental economist at the University of Guelph in Ontario, Canada, and I spoke opposite Bill McKibben, who is the founder of 350.org, a climate alarmist organization, and Rusty Pritchard, who is with Tier Fund, who is an environmental economist, and Matthew Sleet, the founder of Blessed Earth, former emergency room physician, now dedicating himself to what he calls creation care, and unfortunately, I think it's come to embrace climate alarmism. We, the two sides, the three scholars on each side, spoke opposite each other back in April, I guess it was, at New Orleans Baptist Theological Seminary, and it was quite an informative thing. And we've got the rights, we've got the permission to make those videos available to the public. So we're going to be doing that as soon as we're able.
Excellent. Any new? I know you probably don't have time to do this, but correct me if I'm wrong. Are you working on any books, or can you identify or recommend any new books coming out on climate change from a biblical perspective?
Well, actually, there is a small book that we are negotiating with an author with right now. I really can't give details about it at the moment because it's not been written. We do hope to have that out sometime around the end of the year. And I think that'll be very, very clear and straightforward, particularly friendly to non-experts in the field. So we're excited about that.
Yeah. Cal, is there a way for folks to get involved in assisting the Cornwall Alliance?
Well, you know, the thing that we need more than anything else is prayer. I mean, that's the biggest thing. If we had all the money in the world but not God's blessing, well, we might be able to do a whole lot, but it wouldn't probably be for much good.
Yeah.
So we need prayer. We do need financial support as well, and people who go to cornwallalliance.org would have the opportunity to donate there as well. There's a simple donate button on the website. Then also people can get involved by spreading our materials around to their friends, by hosting a viewing of the Resisting the Green Dragon video series, or any of our other videos, one called Blue, that is a documentary exposing the environmental movement by a young man by the name of J.D. King. We have that as well, so people can show those, they can distribute our documents, and they can invite Cornwall Alliance speakers to speak for their churches, colleges, their schools, and conferences and the like. We are glad to provide good speakers anywhere in the country.
Yes, amen. The website is cornwallalliance.org. You can find all kinds of helpful resources there to not only get yourself up to speed, but also perhaps even your pastor and your brothers and sisters in the fellowship that you attend. And Cal, I want to thank you again for joining me on Soaring Eagle Radio. I've really appreciated the conversation.
Well, thank you very much, Mike. It's been enjoyable, and I appreciate so much you're giving me the opportunity to tell your listeners about the Cornwall Alliance.
You're very welcome. Soaring Eagle Radio is a production of Transforming Word Ministries and is released under Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 International License. You may subscribe to the show on iTunes, follow us on Facebook where you can discuss this episode, and follow Soaring Eagle Radio on Twitter at Soaring Eagle Rad. And listen to every episode on our website, www.soaringeagleradio.com. The opening audio montage collection was created by Mica 68 Productions. Visit them on the internet at www.mika68.com for more information. Friends, remember the Apostle Paul's admonition to the believers meeting in Rome. Therefore, I urge you, brethren, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies a living and holy sacrifice, acceptable to God, which is your spiritual service of worship. And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, so that you may prove what the will of God is, that which is good and acceptable and perfect. I'm your host, Mike Spaulding. Thank you for joining us today for this edition of Soaring Eagle Radio.
Thanks for tuning in today to the Soaring Eagle Radio program. For more information about the show, write us at Soaring Eagle Radio, 682 West Grand Avenue, Lima, Ohio, 45801. You may also contact Mike directly by email at the following address, Pastor Mike at woh.rr.